Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. It's another episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast, and this week we have Anne Keeling joining us. From Women in Global Health Senior Fellow is a British citizen whose 40-year career in global health and social development has included posts in Pakistan, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, the Caribbean, Belgium, the USA, and, of course, her home country, the UK. She held the post of Head of Gender Equality Policy with the UK government and is currently the chair of the NGO Age International and Senior Fellow of Women in Global Health. Anne Keeling has been CEO of two global health NGOs, was UN FPA country representative in Pakistan, and director, Commonwealth Secretariat, leading on health, education, and gender. Between 2008 and 2012, she was chief executive officer of the International Diabetes Federation, funded the NCD, that's the Non-Communicable Diseases Alliance, and as chair led the successful campaign for the 2011 UN High-Level Summit on Non-Communicable Diseases. Anne Keeling spent 9 years in Pakistan with the British Council, DFID, and UNDP, working on human development and women's rights. She's also held senior posts with the governments of Papua New Guinea and Pakistan. She studied at Oxford University, UK, Ann Arbor University in the US, and 1981 at the People's University in Beijing. We're very happy to have Anne Keeling join us this week on GDP. Hello, Anne.
Hi, thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great. We're happy to have you. And as some people know, my interests run very deep in global health. So to have someone with such expertise join us this week to talk about global health is fantastic. And particularly the recent publication that you were involved with about the state of leadership of women in global health. This is a fantastic publication, and it makes a strong claim, if I can just repeat it, that as it says, men lead and women deliver. Could you paint a picture of this gender dynamic for us, especially recognizing that more women than ever before are actually entering healthcare professions, but if men are still leading and women are delivering?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2019, we authored a report for World Health Organization, and we called it Global Health Delivered by Women, Led by Men. And at that point, our estimate was that women were 70% of the health workforce, 80% of nurses and midwives at least, and sort of 90% of frontline health workers, because the majority of community health workers are women. And yet they held only 25% of senior leadership roles. So 5 years later, we've done the stats again, and nothing has changed. But what did change was that in the pandemic, women actually lost ground in leadership. So at the beginning of the pandemic, when we surveyed, I think it was 115 national COVID task forces, 85% of them had a majority of men as their members. And that's what that means is that although women are really the experts in health systems because they largely deliver them, when there's an emergency, they get elbowed aside. And even when there's not an emergency, they're entering the health profession in larger numbers than ever before. Women are the majority of health workers under 40. And yet somehow they get stuck in the pipeline. There's a glass ceiling. Some people say men have a glass escalator to the top. You know, we can use all of these phrases, sticky floors, to describe what's happening. But basically, women get stuck at the bottom, and men have a fast track to the top of the health profession.
And is there something particularly unique about health professions that's seeing that glass ceiling be reinforced with extra layers? I mean, it's something that in many professions, this is a big concern, and it ranges from, well, just I'm thinking about any profession from firefighting to leading countries, right? You know, whatever. Yeah. It can be. But is there something about the health system? Is it the education? Is it the workplace that's keeping this gender dynamic so harsh?
Yeah. Yes, there is. And it's occupational segregation. So what that basically means is that, the majority of nurses are women and the majority of surgeons are men. Now, that's not strictly true everywhere because there are a number of countries where the majority of nurses are men. So, you know, what we're seeing is gender stereotypes and gender biases playing out. There's no reason why the majority of nurses need to be women. But it's the gender roles and gender stereotypes in society, it's education that funnels women into one set of professions within health and funnels men into another. And the places that women occupy in health tend to be those that are given lower social value. They're paid less. We did a report about 6 months ago looking at the 6 million or more women in health systems, mainly community health workers, who are actually unpaid or grossly underpaid, given a task-based stipend, for example. So women are very much clustered into parts of the health sector where they can't get out. And they're sort of backed into a gender box, and then they can't get out from where they are. So those women, those unpaid and grossly underpaid community health workers, they don't have a bridge into nursing. They don't have a bridge into studying medicine, for example. They are where they are, and that's really it's the main reason why we see the pattern that we see. But it's also that women are leaders in health. They're leading nursing teams, those community health workers that I was talking about. They're leaders in health in their own communities, but they're not recognized and rewarded as leaders. So it's a question of turning on its head and asking, what do we mean by leadership? What do we value in health? And why does it turn out this way? Where we have a systemic bias towards men as natural leaders. And then when you actually get beyond, you dig into the statistics, you have to take an intersectionality lens and look at, within the women who are underrepresented, who are the most underrepresented. So you find at global level that women from the global South are the least represented. You might find in India, for example, that certain castes of women, in other places it might be certain races. In the US, nursing aides and care assistants are majority Black and Latina women. So even within the groups of women, you've got a hierarchy, and you've got some more marginalized than others. So it's quite a complex picture, but it's based on basically power dynamics and bias.
It's very telling, the way that you just painted that there. And I was thinking back to even work that I was doing, I guess we're looking at 11 years ago in India, taking a very close look at these community health worker projects that actually put gender forward. I remember in the state of Maharashtra, there's several projects there that made sure that if there was going to be community health worker training or the ability to offer scholarships for advancement for community health workers, that some of the initial programs that kind of targeted the community leaders, the men in these villages, they just failed. It didn't work. There was all sorts of problems with it, from people being asked to pay for services or favoritism and providing services. Mm-hmm. And so they went back to the drawing board and they said, well, look, let's get Dalit women as being part of the health workforce here. And not only did you say, like, you nailed it, that it was a lot of work. They're essentially community leaders, but unrecognized. But what often happened was that all of the health statistics just improved. I mean, once those gender dynamics start being readjusted, the health benefits just followed suit, from malnutrition to infant mortality to whatever you want to pick at. And I wonder, is there not a case to be made? It just seems so obvious that the health professions would recognize that overturning gender inequality at high levels may have similar impacts.
Yeah, we think there's a, you know, there's a hell of a business case to be made, and there's a hell of an investment case to be made for gender equity in the health workforce. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, at community level, we've seen women, the Dalit women, other women, quite often unpaid or, you know, very, very underpaid, making a huge difference, particularly on maternal and child health. Really a game changer. And what we also saw in the pandemic was some of the countries that did best because they had an army of women who were already, you know, linking with their communities, that could contact trace, that could spread public health awareness, that could deliver vaccines. You know, those were some of the countries that did very well. But we also saw, you know, health workers in 100 countries go on strike. And amongst them was the very large all-female ASHA community worker, CADA, in India. And it was because the pandemic had, you know, increased their workload but hadn't increased their pay. So I think the pandemic has really changed things, and shone a light on the work of women and the value that women bring. And that's why we're saying, you know, after the pandemic, it can't be going back to gender inequality as, you know, business as usual, that we have to see the pandemic as a break in history. And we have to begin to see this differently and really looking at these women who do create a value. And they have a right as a matter of economic justice to have, you know, fair access to leadership and career opportunities and to pay. But also there's a business case in investing in these women because of, you know, what they produce.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's quite telling that, you know, as you mentioned, the pandemic, I know that there's quite a few reports from various agencies, and I believe UNICEF was one of them that discussed, not with, say, COVID per se, but with other illnesses, polio being one, that building trust for receipt of medication is incredibly important. And they actually highlighted how there's often gender dynamics are what often hold back vaccine hesitancy in many parts of the world, for example, where there's still polio prevalent in that way. I wonder if we can also just sort of look outside of the global south for a minute and more even to just push on some of the European, North American countries, Australia, New Zealand, where you see that in some cases, in Canada in particular, more than half of medical students now are mm-hmm. women, but not the case when you start looking at the professions that come out. You've got the entry of medical students being, you know, in favor of women, but then when it comes to the surgeons and when it comes to the leadership roles, that also declines. And I'm wondering, is there something going on within medical education or within developed nations as well that's leading to this?
Yeah, I think, you know, change is coming, but change is slow. And it's going to be much too slow for this generation. And there's no reason why we should condemn, you know, the next generation of female medical students to the same outcome. And I think, you know, when medicine was established as a profession, it was established by men for men, and it completely excluded women from training and practice. So the laws and policies that you have around medicine in many countries, even in, you know, rich countries, are still designed on men's lives. And so, you know, the US, for example, has no statutory maternity leave entitlement. If we are to look at the health workforce and say, well, the majority of people working in this health work, in this workforce are women, then we need to be looking at, you know, what do women need in order to be able to avoid what's often known as the motherhood penalty, that women fall behind because the laws and policies around them don't, you know, basically don't fit their lives. And we need to be looking at the sort of policies that will begin to redistribute some of the unpaid care work between men and women, because we know that everywhere, including in high-income countries, women are doing more unpaid care work at home, which has an impact on what they can do at work. So there are ways in which you can formulate policies towards more parental leave policies and family-friendly policies that will actually be good for men as well as women, rather than saying, right, okay, we'll just have maternity leave and only women will get to take time off.
I think that's a great point. I just to quickly cut in, we had a podcast last year on the series that dealt with exactly that, to say that, even a country like Canada offers some of the most generous paternity leave in the business. But I think it's like a shocking 20% of men actually take it,
That's right. Yeah. And there are ways of changing that. So I think quite often if we have parental leave and we say that it's transferable between men and women, then fathers won't take it. They'll be under pressure not to take it, and women will take it. Whereas if we say, here's a parental leave entitlement, and it's a father's entitlement, and he either takes it or he loses it, he's much more likely to take it. And eventually over time, it will become much more socially acceptable to see fathers taking paternity leave, longer paternity leave, to actually look after their children, as they would in countries like Sweden. But that just didn't happen overnight in Sweden. It's, you bring in the policies, and then you have to nudge culture, and you have to nudge stereotypes so that people actually change their behavior.
It's incredible. I think you're right on the money with that. And it's something, when we just to also, once again, hit back to Canada, when women are in positions of leadership, like we saw in the pandemic, in Canada, not only do we have chief medical officer for the whole country, it's Dr. Theresa Tam, but many of the provinces and some cities actually had women who were the chief medical officers for those jurisdictions, who were right in the public media dealing with COVID policy and quarantines. And the feedback, it was just enormously positive towards it. People really took to that sense of leadership during the pandemic. And it's, again, you just see that the results are so obvious when opportunities are presented, and the lack of, shall we say, its internal movement to see this being a more universal experience is just shocking. So, I mean, are there systematic obstacles that are in the road that we can't break? I mean, paternity leave is certainly one of them. Are there other factors here as well?
Yes, it's those policies and laws. So first of all, we need to make sure that countries have the, fundamental legal frameworks in place, and a lot of them don't. So a lot of them don't have proper maternity, paternity, parental leave, for example. As a number of countries still don't have, effective laws against sexual harassment, for example. So, there's a suite of laws which are the foundation that then feed into organizational policies. That's important. I think the second thing is really, changing the narrative to see women as drivers of change in health systems and not just beneficiaries. That's really important. And the more role models you get of women in senior positions, like the ones that we're talking about in Canada, so the more female role models you have of women in senior positions, the more those are seen by both early career men and women, and the more people get used to just having, women in leadership positions. We're not saying that women are better leaders than men. And I'm never going to say that women are born with a kindness gene or a caring gene. Not necessarily. But I think what we have found, and it's maybe to do with the way that women, have been brought up, that women will adopt at least a different linguistic style. And I think we saw that with leaders like Jacinda Ardern, for example, in the pandemic, with a more collective style, talking about, we're going to approach this as a team of 5 million people. That's what she said to the New Zealand people. and we're going to think about each other rather than maybe a more individualistic approach, which we saw from some male leaders that were more in denial and, you know, we're just going to push this back. And it was a different way of handling the pandemic. But I don't believe that women are necessarily born that way, because if I thought that, then I would be saying that there's no way that men can adopt a different leadership style. So I don't think there's any genetic in here.
Yeah. No. And I think it's less about, just like you say, perhaps it got something more to do with just sort of overcoming the blind spots that come into a situation of any leadership style that is not appreciative of gender inclusivity. That if you're trying to create public marching orders, as it were, as the pandemic showed, that here's the advice we're going to give. At the core of it, it was a lot of basic hygiene and social distancing and follow the prompts. But the way that it's articulated to be inclusive and to be respectful of the diversity of needs is, I think, very telling. And I think we could probably map that out to see which jurisdictions did that the best. It's really about overcoming those blind spots and thinking about approaches to issues that others may be missing. And, if it's on gender lines, then we can see that that those blind spots can be quickly exposed. And I think really, the more people that you have dealing with a problem and seeing it from different directions, the only the better it can be in terms of finding solutions.
Absolutely. So we would want all leaders to be diverse, to be representative of the populations that that they're serving. That makes absolute sense. So it's not just men and women 50-50. It's also looking at the racial composition of the society, the indigenous composition, so many other things. But so that you've got people at the table who've really got the lived experience of that community and can bring diverse perspectives. So we're looking for diversity and we're looking for equal numbers of women at the table.
And it's and the other thing I'll just sort of add in, as you mentioned, Jacinda Ardern, there's been a lot of celebration about just how inclusive her tone was through that crisis, as there had been through previous crises in New Zealand, like of course there was a mosque shooting and the earthquake that preceded that. But the other thing is there was also a sternness to it as well, a lot of her language. When New Zealand was hitting levels 3 and level 4, the language was, you must stay home, you must do this. And it wasn't taunting, like, well, if you don't do this, here's the consequence. No, you must. That in a way is almost like a I don't know what you would call it. It's compassionate, it's stern, and yet it's convincing. It's some of the clearest public health communication I've ever heard.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. It's clear. It's clear what you want people to do, and you're not mocking mask wearing, or you're not treating public health measures as though somehow you're unmanly if you follow them. You're just saying straight, okay, we've got this issue, and this is what we have to do.
Yeah. So on that, or just sort of as we wind this one down, where can we get action going on this? I mean, where does the movement need to happen to get this much needed gender equity into our global healthcare frameworks? Do we need to go to Geneva to have conversations there? Are the nurses unions the way forward? Do we need to talk to leaders, say, in the Philippines, where there's mass encouragement of women go into nursing and men go into shipping? Where do you think the conversation needs to go next?
I think we need to work at all levels. So we need to work at Geneva. We need, in certain places, we need affirmative action. So we need, temporary measures such as quotas or, all women shortlists when there's a senior position coming up that's maybe never been held by a woman before, that we say, okay, that will be an all women shortlist. Only women will be able to stand for that post. And then countries will put forward the best women that they've got. At the moment, when there's a competition, you'll quite often see countries putting forward, their strongest men, but not necessarily the women that they've got with the strongest CVs. And you can look at the competition, you can think, well, actually, those women are never going to get that job. But it would be taken a lot more seriously if you had an all-women shortlist. So in certain places, that's going to have to happen. That's the only way that's actually going to create the sort of momentum that is needed to really shift this. And then it's needed at all levels. And the way in which to get it going at all levels is really to look at collective action. And mm-hmm. you've mentioned the nurses' union, but it could be, trade unions are very active on this. Our own network, Women in Global Health, has got chapters in nearly 50 countries. And we work with alliances on men's health, for example. So everyone in a way recognizing that there is an issue, and that's why we wrote the report, to say, okay, there is an issue and we need to do something about it. And it's in everybody's interest to do something about it because there's only one health system and you want the best people at the table making decisions. And if you don't have that, then in a way, everybody's health suffers. So it's this business case for really taking action on gender equity. It's a no-brainer as far as we're concerned, but we're writing these reports to get that across.
And the creative solutions that can be welcomed, like you say, with paternity leave. It was a podcast in April of 2021 that we had in the series with Gary Barker, who made just a profound case for having paternity to be more widely accepted. I mean, this is where we'll hopefully go with finding ways to knot that glass ceiling that just hasn't cracked yet. But I'm with you. I hope that that these conversations come at multiple levels and in ways that will only help deliver better health benefits down the road, because we've seen so many cases when gender equity improves that, well, health follows. It really does.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Anne Keeling, I want to thank you very much for joining us on GDP this week and to talk about your latest report that's come out that's dealing with the state of leadership of women in global health. And again, making that claim that men lead, women deliver. So thank you very much for sharing with our listeners why we need to see that pattern come to an end.
Thank you so much. Thank you.